An early look at the Copa America favourites, why every Copa Libertadores winner seems to be from Brazil right now, and how to find betting value in South American football from the expert himself. All that and more on this very special show. Hello and welcome to a rather unique episode of the Betting Expert Football Podcast, joined as ever by Betting Experts football editor Sam Ingram. How you doing, mate?
Hello, Dan. Very good. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. Now, Sam, we had a little chat earlier with our South American expert and betting expert writer, Nathan Joyce. Good little conversation, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. It's one of those guys who you can tell is really passionate about what he does and really quite knowledgeable too. Really interesting in terms of maybe just learning a little bit about South American football and also the alternative angles you can take when betting on South American football too. So I learned a little bit and I'm sure our listeners will too.
Yeah, definitely. Now, the original aim was to include the interview in our standard weekly episode, but I think it was such a good conversation that we decided to publish it separately as a standalone show. So without further ado, here's our discussion with Nathan. A very warm welcome to our South American expert, Nathan Joyce. How are you doing, mate?
Yeah, very well. I'm glad to be the first guest on it. It seems like quite the honour.
It is a huge honour. That's good to have you on. I mean, I've followed your content on your socials for a very long time. You've kind of got your niche in South American football, and I'm just curious where that came from. I've never really asked you about it. So it's not really the most traditional route for a football fan in the UK. So can you just walk us through your story and how you came to find this interest in South American football?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have too much of an explanation. I first started betting, really, I was interested in looking at alternative angles, always like the niche nitty-gritty stories, whether it's like in Asia or South America. I've always preferred that sort of angle and trying to find a good story behind a bet rather than your Saturday 3 p.m. kickoffs in the Premier League. But my first job was at William Hill in Gibraltar, and I had to do a few of like the donkey shifts out there, and where loads of people would catch up on normal TV, I started watching like Bolivian football. And for some reason, that passion just sort of ignited into like the Copa Libertadores. And I was like, why are Bolivian teams winning in a Libertadores against like River Plate? That doesn't make sense to me. And sort of went down like a bit of a rabbit hole and started getting involved with like the altitude problems and the traveling and everything else, which you don't get in Europe because of mainly money, right? Teams have it and there's no huge traveling and all these problems which you get in South America. So it all sort of snowballed from there, really, and I really enjoyed the betting angles from it. And then I just got involved with like the stories and the passion behind it, and no one else really covers it. So I almost found an angle in the last couple of years. It just sort of fell in my lap, really. Forest signed Danilo, and obviously being a Forest fan, I was quite interested in that, and people just started asking me about it, so I started writing about it and people jumped on my content. So I just sort of felt like, well, why can't I do a little bit more? And over the last 18 months, it's almost snowballed and escalated, really. But it's not something which is new to me. I've been doing it for the last 10 years and quit full-time work to sit and watch the Copa Libertadores, Argentinian football, Brazilian football at silly o'clock across the weeks and months of the season. So you know you're actually getting stuff from someone who doesn't just watch YouTube clips like a lot of people do.
Yeah, you were the guy showing up to work on Monday morning with bags under your eyes after staying up until
2 a.m. Yeah, sorry
about that. No, I wasn't saying anything. So what do you think the appetite's like from an English-speaking audience for South American football right now? Would you say it's increasing, and does it vary throughout the season? Because obviously they'll play throughout the summer when the European leagues have stopped.
I think it's growing massively, and I'm not just saying that because I have a business within it, but the Copa Libertadores final, I think it was the most watched in the UK in a long time. It's a shame because the final is normally such a disappointment from a footballing perspective because there's so much at stake, but more people are getting interest in it. And I think because the rules have relaxed around transfers and work permit, probably the only good thing Brexit actually brought to the table was allowing this, and more players are coming across to European leagues and predominantly the Premier League. And because fees are so much smaller, it's given clubs outside the top four almost an opportunity to actually remain competitive as much as financial fair play will allow it. But there is just that nice link now across to Europe for cheap sums, and teams like Brighton have done it perfectly, but they're not doing anything like special, to be honest with you. They just have people in the right places, and more clubs should be doing that. But I'm really enjoying the fact that the smaller teams, so to speak, in the Premier League in Europe are actually having a look and bringing players over. And for me, it's just a case of like educating people and letting people know. And especially with my business, which is mainly like player profiling stuff, people are just desperate to know about transfers, right? People are always keen to know who the next best player is and all that. And so if I can be the middleman and supply that information and put my opinion across, I think I've definitely seen much more of an appetite, especially when it comes to the transfer window, because fees are getting ridiculous, or they have been for a while. Like, obviously, if you want anyone like Declan Rice, who is a proven player, 100 million plus, or you can go and take a 10 million, 20 million gamble in South America. And I use the word gamble. That's what the media like to use, but I don't really see it is. If like football clubs are going out there and actually profiling the right players to see if they can be a good fit, then you're saving such a wedge of money. But the top four are still almost using other teams as guinea pigs to see if they will work before potentially buying them for 50, 60, 70 million, because they have that luxury. And teams like that are expected to have, like, yeah, Man United, Man City, whatever, they expect to have success every single week, every single game. They don't have that luxury of bedding in players, so they would rather someone like Wolves, Forest, Brighton, trial a player for 12 months before bringing them over and then obviously reaping the rewards. But for now, I'm quite content, especially with Forest, as long as they still stay in the Premier League, diving into that market, teams like Brighton, Wolves. And Cercle Brugge is like a really niche one, but they're a team in Belgium who are excelling at that, and they've got a few South American players on their books at the moment looking to come across, and they'll make good money out of it, which means football clubs can be sustainable away from just your typical top six.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought this up. I was going to talk about this next, but we've definitely seen more of a push from mid-table Premier League clubs to sign directly from South America. I think we've had 8 transfers directly from South America to the Premier League this season. I think it was 11 last season. I went back, 2018-19, it was 5 years ago. There were only 2, yeah. And one of them was Alexis McAllister. Why do you think this is? Is it people trying to follow the Brighton model, trying to get the next Moises Caicedo before Moises Caicedo is a £100 million player?
I think so. I think mainly because, like I said, the work permits have relaxed a lot. And the rule and around Brexit, that's also had like a positive effect in terms of being able to bring players over. Before, there were so many complications, and that seems to have been taken out now. But I think purely because of how expensive players are in the market, if you want to be a sustainable team in the Premier League, like Brighton have become, but they've had to buy and sell and prove themselves over the last 5-6 years, they have to look away from the obvious markets. And even Europe's becoming an obvious market, especially like the transfer window has just become a show in its own, hasn't it? In terms of like, there's no hiding places for any of these players. If you look back 5 years ago, these 16, 17 year olds, you may not have heard about them, but now all across social media, they're in your face, and you're probably bored of hearing about them before they've even transferred across. Now, South America still has that niche to an extent. We're hearing about them. Maybe I am more so because obviously I'm directly involved with it, but the fees, which are there. For example, Fluminense didn't sell Andre, who's Brazil's next best number 6, in my opinion, because they wanted 25, 30 million for him, and Europe turned around and said, how dare you charge that? Because most players are half that price, and the Premier League pretend that they don't have any money in these situations. But then on the flip side of it as well, there's over the last 2 or 3 years, if I'm going to get all political for a couple of minutes, Brazilian law has changed, which has allowed basically owners of like Arab investors or Europe investors to come over and actually buy the clubs. So like John Texter's bought Botafogo and pumped a load of money into the club. Bahia owned by the City Group. And that rule's just changed for Argentina as well. There's a bit of hesitancy about clubs there because they don't want to become part of this political ladder, which has happened in Europe. But because that's happening, there's more and more links. So if like we've seen with City having a good relationship with River Plate now, and in terms of Julian Alvarez and now Claudio Echeverri, like that's happening more and more often. So they're putting those strings in place and attaching them across. So make sure that they are the players and they are the teams who are signing these players first and foremost before anyone else can hear from them. So I'm a little apprehensive as to where it's going to go in 5-10 years, but there are positive signs because teams in Brazil are plucking players from Europe over the last couple of years. So they're almost stealing them back. So it'd be interesting to see exactly where that goes.
Yeah, definitely. It's not just the players who are 16, 17 who are about to move to Europe, and then players who are 32, 33, bit of a retirement home. Yeah, getting some people, players in their prime, which is good to see. So just to switch up the pace a little bit, there is maybe some hesitancy from European football fans when following South American football. I think it's quite difficult to find a place to jump in for brand new league structures, styles of football, histories for different clubs. What do you think is the best starting point for someone who's never really followed South American football that seriously? Is it the Libertadores, for example?
I think it's the Libertadores because that's what sold it to me, because there's so many different angles from it which you don't get in Champions League football, for example. Yes, you'll always get a few minnows winning here and there, but there's altitude factors, travelling, like I've touched on the Bolivian teams who, like, the strongest last year beat River Plate in the opening game of the season, but that is the norm, to be honest with you. Like, no one likes to go to high places like Quito in Ecuador, or like Barranquilla, which is in Colombia, which is just sweltering hot. So that has all these interesting angles, really, where it makes it more of a level playing field. And obviously, if you were to take both a Bolivian team and an Argentinian team out and put it in a neutral environment, we know who the winner would be. But I think that's what makes the tournament so special, to be honest with you. But if you're really going to hone in on it, the Brazilian top flight last season was unbelievable. Around about five or six teams could still win it with three or four games to go. Imagine that in the Premier League. It just wouldn't happen. And like, the fixture is actually four on like a Sunday between like 3 to 7 p.m. And like, streaming is pretty easy through bookmakers, or there's certain streaming platforms which are around about $5, which are legal to get, which I should probably mention. But you can get involved there from like 7 p.m. onwards, where a lot of people are watching European football. The Brazilian football money is being pumped into at the moment. It's getting better and better. It's the best league in South America. And like I said, last year was just a roller coaster. Botafogo with 14 points clear and bottled it. And it was just unbelievable for them to even be in that situation. So there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of angles, and I'm not expecting people to listen to this and all of a sudden start watching Ecuadorian football every week. But watch the Copa Libertadores, especially the knockout rounds, some of the best football you will see. And I think just purely because anyone can beat anyone in this competition, and the passion behind it. And it's just raw football stripped away from the money politics. And I think that's what I like about it, away from like, someone has X amount of money, so they're likely to win over the season. It doesn't always happen in South American football.
Yeah. Moving on to the betting side of things, a lot of people who bet will have a passing interest in South American football, mostly down to the kickoff times and a bit of variety compared to the European stuff. Sam, I think that's the situation with you, right?
Yeah, definitely a passing interest. It's not somewhere I usually frequent, really, unless there's a big fixture in Brazil or Argentina, like, I don't know, like a River Plate Boca final or something, and there's like a array of card markets that usually turns into a bit of a bloodbath. So don't mind getting involved in that, which is good fun. I'll keep an eye out for Nathan's previews, of course, on Betting Expert 2. That's largely where it ends for me, though, I think, until Copa America rolls around. And that's probably where I think most bettors become much more engaged in that part of the world.
Yeah, definitely. Nathan, for you, if punters do want to start finding value in South American leagues, what is some general advice you can give them that differentiates it from the top European leagues?
Yeah, I'm going to try not to use the buzzword altitude throughout this podcast too many times, but it's just the perfect angle. So just to dive into that a little bit further, Bolivian teams in like the Copa Libertadores, they're based in two of them, Bolivar and the strongest are based in La Paz, which is 3,500 meters above sea level. So there's like 40% less oxygen in the air, or 50% compared to where we are, for example. And there's no altitude in Brazil. So Brazilian teams hate going across there. Players feel nauseous. They can't breathe, sometimes substituted in the first half. It's an absolute minefield to go and play there. Like, Brazilian and Argentinian teams have like always made it very clear that they don't want Bolivian teams in the competition, or they don't want to travel there. So that always puts up extreme value, especially in the early rounds of the Libertadores. It's always missed. Like, a lot of teams will even send reserve teams. Fluminense played the strongest last year and lost 1-0, but they hadn't even qualified, and they sent a reserve team, as did Palmeiras when they played Bolivar. Now, that's never picked up by the bookmakers, because they just want, they know over six games in the group stage that they will squeeze through. So they always sacrifice the basically the 3 points, or even a draw when they go to Bolivian teams, which is always fairly interesting. And people turn around and go, oh, it must be an unfair advantage for the Bolivian team. But they suffer out of it as well. So the air in the ball also impacts, like, the altitude in the, sorry, I can't explain it. The altitude actually impacts the air within the football as well. So Brazil played in, like, the early 2000s, played Bolivia, and they were struggling and didn't know how to beat them. They actually went and trained with volleyballs beforehand because they're so much lighter from free kicks. It didn't work. They still lost that game. But that just goes to show, like, Bolivians know how to, like, shoot from 30, 40 yards and, like, score some absolute worldies in this. But when they move away from their usual conditions, the ball's heavier for them. Okay, they also struggle because they're not used to that environment as well. So it's 50-50 in terms of where they are. So Bolivian teams really struggle out of their conditions. But in it, like, they're really strong and always a great way to back. But it's not just Bolivian teams which have the altitude as well. Like, Ecuador, Quito is the second highest city in the world, so they also have their advantage. I've touched on Barranquilla in Colombia, which is the most northern city in South America, where it's obviously extremely hot next to the Caribbean Sea. And then right at the other end, Argentina can be freezing at times, so Bolivian teams hate going there for the completely opposite. So South America has an array of weather conditions and an environment which is not seen anywhere else in the world. And there's also vast amount of traveling as well, and budgets and stuff like that. And if you dive even deeper into it with the Libertadores, a lot of smaller teams, because of CONMEBOL regulations, aren't even allowed to play at their own stadiums and have to travel 700 kilometers to an empty stadium. And that's missed by the bookmakers as well. And that makes it a neutral game when it should probably be an advantage to the home side. So I find that far more interesting than a 3 p.m. kickoff between, say, like, Forest and Brighton, for example. I think, like, it's always a sense of achievement if you find this information out, and especially if it wins. So that's sort of my angle for it.
Yeah, definitely. Just ask yourself, could they do it on a cold Tuesday night in La Paz?
Yeah, exactly. It's never cold. Don't worry about that.
It's never going to happen. So I want to move on to the Copa America. Obviously, yeah, a big summer ahead with international tournaments coming up. I mean, we'll have plenty of Copa tips and analysis on the site when the time comes around. But right now, I think it's best to just take an early look at some of the big favourites while we've got you here, Nathan.
Yeah,
and just want to run through it team by team, starting with Argentina, the Copa holders, World Cup champions, plenty to discuss with them. So we'll start quite broad. Nathan, they're the favourites for this tournament at around 2.75 odds best price. Do you think that's justified?
In a word, yes. And I don't really want to come onto a podcast and just say the favourites are going to win it. But for a team who only lost two games in, a team that's only lost two games in, like, 40, 50 fixtures, and there's just so much quality throughout that team, right? And everyone thought, it was Lionel Messi's last tournament for Qatar, so that had the happy ending. But people keep forgetting about Copa America, and he's in his own environment as well. So he's nurtured and got used to his conditions in the US as well. And he just run through their team. I've had to make a list because of how good their players are in midfield. McAllister, Enzo Fernandez, Depaul, Martinez, Di Maria, Alvarez, Messi. Like, the list goes on, to be honest with you. And there's just so much quality throughout that. Now, they've won every single World Cup qualifier, aside from one, which we'll get onto, I'm sure. But they've just been consistent across the board, and they have no issues going away from home in that competition, which can normally find a lot of teams out. As we've just spoke about, the Libertadores, it has the same effect with national teams because most players for Argentina, Brazil, etc., are European. So obviously that impacts them away from not being used to the conditions as much. They're just all around the perfect package, aren't they? I mean, we spoke about that Saudi Arabia defeat as if, like, the world had ended at the start of at the beginning of the World Cup, but they rectified that problem, no issue. And yes, they lost to Uruguay 2-0 in Buenos Aires. I think there's a couple of reasons behind that, but these things do happen. They bounce back and beat Brazil. So yeah, I think it's a good price, to be honest. It's the unknown quantity of Brazil, which we'll get on and talk about shortly. But at that price, for me, like, I put it in January, so I'm going to stand by it for my column, rather. But yeah, I just think it's a no-brainer. Don't overcomplicate this. Argentina will be there or thereabouts.
Okay, good. You mentioned the Saudi Arabia match there and the Uruguay game. Those are the only two matches they've lost in about 50-odd games. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and obviously that Saudi game was mad, wasn't it? And the winner of that would have won any football game, to be honest. And it was just one of those days for Argentina. Like, if they lost 5 or 6 in 50, okay, we could probably examine that a little bit further. But they've lost 2 in 50-plus games. So I don't think there's reason to panic just yet. I don't think that will happen in the summer. So famous last words when they get knocked out quite early. But I think at that price, I think it's too good, to be honest. It should be a lot closer to our unevens.
Okay. They've kept most of the team together. It's not like after the World Cup, we saw a host of players retiring or moving on. Obviously, Lionel Messi and Paulo Dybala are injured at the moment, but should be back in time for the summer tournament. Are there any other players who are threatening to take a place in this winning team? Or is it just a case of manager Lionel Scaloni keeping a good thing going?
The latter, to be honest with you, but their under-20 team might keep an eye out on the Olympics in Paris and the amount of quality they've got coming through. So a few names you would have heard of, Valentin Barco, who's just gone to Brighton, Thiago Almada, who had like 30, 35 goals and assists combinations in the MLS since he moved across to Atlanta United. He's looking to come through. Federico Redondo, who's just gone to Inter Miami, heavily linked to be the next Sergio Busquets, but he annoyed a lot of people by going north into Miami, but I mean, he gets to play with Lionel Messi, so I think he'll just about be all right with that one, but he'll soon head across to Europe. There's so much talent coming through. It's quite scary, to be honest, how prepared they are already and the amount of experience these young lads have got. So look, maybe one or two will be introduced into the squad, but yeah, I don't think, I can't see too much changing, to be honest with you.
Okay. As I said, they are the Copa America champions, the World Cup holders, and it's almost felt like fate at times with Messi winning his first major tournaments with his national team. This Copa is taking place in the United States. The final will be in Miami, Messi's new home. Do you think it'll just be the same sort of thing here?
I don't really know what else to sort of add to that. It just all seems to line up, doesn't it? It'd be a shock if they don't, to be honest with you. I think Brazil coming into this, a bit of an unknown quantity, to be honest with you. Uruguay, yes, they've been stronger. They've got a few question marks around them. But aside from that, I've not done too much research into like Mexico and the US and stuff, but I think they're at the top of the market over quite a few of the South American teams. And I can't seem to get my head around that at the moment, maybe because I'm so invested in looking at the South American nations, but they are particularly short around that. So I think that's what's made Argentina's price even better, to be honest with you.
Okay. Last word on the two Lionels. Scaloni and Messi have formed a pretty good partnership, I think it's fair to say, and of course delivered Argentina's first World Cup since 1986. Scaloni's been in charge since 2018 and is contracted until after the next World Cup in 2026. But there has been plenty of speculation that this will be the last major tournament both for him and for Messi with Argentina. Nathan, I'm not expecting the inside scoop here, but do you think this will be the last time we see either or both with Argentina?
I think so, to be honest with you. He came out and he did a bit of a Jurgen Klopp. He came out after one of the World Cup qualifiers and said the weight of expectation managing Argentina here, like, I don't know how long I'm going to do it. And it caught everybody off guard. Nobody expected. There was a bit of panic for a 48-hour period until he came around and said, like, look, just to clarify, I am staying on. But it's almost as if you would have expected that to come after the win in the World Cup, like directly to be like, do you know what? This will be my last tournament, or I will see one more World Cup. But it's almost as if like the fixture list and like the pressure of the job, like he has nothing else to prove. So if he can bow out on a high here in the summer, there's no expectations for him to go into the next World Cup. And I'd be surprised if he carries on, to be honest. He's achieved everything and more. It's probably the perfect time to walk away, especially if Messi was leaving. I know exactly what I'd be doing as well.
Yeah, don't blame him. So moving on to the second favourites in Brazil, but yeah, it's been a pretty dire few months for them, in all honesty. They've lost three consecutive matches for the first time in over 20 years. A new manager in charge now as well. They're third since the 2022 World Cup. Nathan, what's going on?
It's been a car crash. It's been the worst year in their entire history since records began for Brazil. And yeah, it all stemmed from the World Cup, really. Obviously disappointing when they got knocked out to Croatia. Tite was obviously sacked at that point, and they were almost biding their time waiting for Carlo Ancelotti to come in. So they turned to Ramon Menezes, who was the under-20 coach, to almost just steer the ship until Ancelotti was made available. But he lost to Morocco. They lost to Senegal. I think it was 4-2 in a friendly. They were battered. They were really embarrassed. And at that point, the Brazilian FA were like, okay, we need to get somebody in before Ancelotti comes in or becomes available. I spoke with Tim Vickery on my podcast, and he said at the time Ancelotti was learning Portuguese, so was his wife. They were ready to take the position. But obviously what's happened and what's unfolded over the last few months, he's gone, this isn't a retirement job for me. This is a rebuild. Why would I walk away from Real Madrid and I don't want it? But what Brazil did in between is they brought in Fluminense's Fernando Diniz. he didn't walk away from Fluminense because obviously he went on to win the Libertadores. So he was balancing the Fluminense job, which has pressure in itself, and the Brazilian national team. And as you said, they lost three games in a row. They drew with Venezuela at home, 1-1. And it was an absolute car crash. It was a terrible appointment. I don't want to put too much blame on Fernando Diniz, because his style of play, which sort of everyone sort of became familiar with last year, because all through his relationship and style of play, rather than actually looking at positions, like the complete opposite to how Pep Guardiola sees football. He almost revolutionized the modern game. It was really interesting to see. Like, definitely go back and watch Fluminense games from last season. Like, the tactics were outrageous. If they were on the left-hand side, 10 of the players would be there. 80 yards of space, crowding. It was phenomenal. But that took time with his squad, like day in, day out with the same players for 10 months in a row in order to get that working. That wasn't done overnight. Now, he came into the Brazilian national team where they told him, look, you are the interim manager here. But Diniz was just like, no, like, I am the actual manager here. He refused to even acknowledge Carlo Ancelotti's name. But then he was dealing with a squad of 75%, 80% European players who flew over to Brazil, had one or two training sessions where they had to forget everything they knew about football and learn a new style of play, and then implement that against like Uruguay, Argentina, and then even fell short against Venezuela. The players didn't know what they were doing. Now, is that Diniz's fault or is that the Brazilian FA's fault? Probably the latter, to be honest, because it ruined the chances of Carlo Ancelotti coming in. And now they've turned to Dorival Jr., who's probably the right appointment, to be honest. But he's got a hard job now to figure out exactly what he wants to do with these players and make sure that they're going to be competitive against Argentina at Copa America. So it's going to be really interesting to see. But yeah, it's been a whirlwind 12 months and it's not a Brazilian team I'm used to. I'm probably showing my age, but looking at the midfield choices for the England game, yes, they've got so many injuries, but it's not a Brazilian team that I could recognise, to be honest, or would have any confidence about.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely see that. What can we expect from Dorival Jr.? He's a bit of a journeyman coach by the looks of it from, you know, my very European eyes.
Yeah, do you know what? From outside in, though, he's won, like last season, he won the Copa do Brasil with Sao Paulo for the first time in their history. Okay. And that tournament, you get more money for winning the Copa do Brasil than a Brasileiro. So, like, that's taken seriously. So, it's not like the FA Cup here where you'll see the likes of Chelsea or United rotate. Like, clubs take that very seriously. So, for him to win that with Sao Paulo was massively impressive. And he beat Flamengo in the final, who were his previous employers, where the year before he'd also won the Copa do Brasil and the Libertadores. So that's three knockout tournaments he's won. Yes, domestic level, but three knockout tournaments, he's won over the last 2 years. So that's highly impressive. Now, the formation he plays, he likes to go back to a 4-3-3/4-5-1, which will suit Brazil in terms of, I think, the starting three for the England games likely to be Vinicius Junior, Rodrigo and Endrick. So three very strong players in attack. And then he likes to line up with two defensive midfielders as well, but like a number six who can operate as a number eight. So Lucas Paqueta, when he comes back into the team, he's going to be that star in the midfield to sort of link up with attacks. So on paper, with Brazil, I don't think you need to overcomplicate it. You can just go back to what you're used to here and reverting away from Fernando Diniz's like crazy tactics, and something which Brazilian players will be more used to should work for them. It's going to be interesting to see, though, because he's only got a couple of games before Copa America to start, and he's got like 16, 17 injuries. So we're not even going to see the team he wants against England and Spain. So he's almost just got that training camp before to get it right. So that's a lot of pressure on him. And he obviously knows that he wasn't the first choice either. He was plan B/plan C. So it will be interesting to see, but he has winning mentality. He has wins on his CV and recent history as well with Sao Paulo, for example, in the Copa do Brasil. However, if I'm going to throw one more negative in that, they only won one away game in the league last season. One. It was the second worst record in the whole of the Brasileiro. And that came in a 1-0 win against Bahia in round 36 of 38. So there's something didn't quite click away from home. So it'd be really interesting to see exactly how he lines up there. There's a lot of positives, there's a lot of negatives, but there's a lot of unknowns. So at their price, I'll be definitely avoiding them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, 3.25 looks very, very short considering that situation. From what you said, stay clear. Okay, so no Neymar this summer, obviously with injury, but there's no shortage of quality in the attack. You've mentioned Vinicius Junior, Rodrigo, also got Rafinha and Richarlison, but I do want to speak about Endrick, who you touched upon. He'll be completing his move to Real Madrid about a week after the final. Could this be a breakout tournament for him?
Oh, definitely. This kid is like the next best striker in the world. He's probably the next Mbappe, if you want a good thumbnail for this podcast. But he almost won Palmeiras the title himself last year. Like, he was only 17, moving on to 18. And Abel Ferreira, like, didn't want to play him all that much, to be honest with you. He wanted to conserve him and look after him. But when the title was out of their reach, seemingly, they changed the formation, made him the star of the show, went on to score 11 goals. And almost won them the title. Now, they were 3-0 down at home to Botafogo and came back to win 4-3. And he scored two goals, which sort of changed that game. And one of them, he actually purposely like controlled the ball with his shin onto his left foot and then unleashed a rocket. Go back and watch it. I advise everybody to check out that. Just not because the game was 4-3, but it was just the Endrick show. Like, he came here and was like, I'm 18, but I'm going to carry this team. And now he's made his debut for the national team, and like, he doesn't look 18 if you watch him, for the size of him, really. Yes, he's fairly small, but he's stocky. His legs are well built. He's just got the mentality. Like, he got asked in a recent interview about how does he remain so calm on the pitch. And he said, at times, I'm just going around with a song in my head. And then when the ball comes to me, I just flick a switch and I'm there, which was a little bit of an odd comment. But for an 18-year-old to be like, nothing phases me. And look what I did with Palmeiras last season. It's going to be really interesting to see. And like, with Vinicius Junior and Rodrigo either side of him, right, you couldn't get better service. And not like he necessarily needs it at times. He's one who can drop deep and strike from range, and he's just deadly in the box. And I just feel like this tournament could really be the making of him as well. But I think he's going to pick up Ballon d'Ors two or three times over the next 10 years. And he's that good, to be honest with you. So yeah, he's going to be really exciting to see him, to be honest.
Do you think he's going to go to Real Madrid and start alongside your Bellinghams and Mbappes from the off?
At first, I was a little bit worried, and I was almost looking at like the Odegaard situation when he went to Castilla, and then it didn't quite work out for him. But I think over the last 6 months, Endrick has proven that he's more than capable of stepping up. It's a little bit worrying that the Real Madrid obviously chasing Mbappe, aren't they? And that looks likely to happen at some point over the next year or two. But for me, I wouldn't necessarily say that's make or break. You've got Endrick coming. I think he's going to go straight into that 11. I don't think it's going to be any problems, to be honest with you. I don't see a bedding in problem to be any sort of issue, just because of his mentality and how he's been like over the last 6 months, and then transitioning to the national team and taking everything in his stride. I think Saturday, even if Brazil don't win, which I'm not expecting them to, I think just like little glimpses of what he can showcase to a European audience, people will realise. And look, Vitor Roque has gone to Barcelona and he's been in and out of the squad, but his goal record per minute has been pretty good, to be honest with you. And Vitor Roque is class, but Endrick, I'm sorry, he's on a different level. So I'm fully expecting him to almost have a Bellingham sort of season. This is another clip, isn't it, which you can show me in 6 months down the line and I've got it wrong. But I think he's that good, to be honest. And I hope you can tell in the tone of my voice how excited I am for him to come across and start banging in the goals for Real Madrid.
Fantastic. Let's move on from Brazil and Argentina, away from the big two. And I think it's definitely worth discussing Uruguay in this Copa America discussion. With Marcelo Bielsa in charge and Darwin Nunez up front, I don't think they could be any more of a dark horse if they tried. Is that how you see them at this tournament, Nathan?
I think it's a little bit unfair to call him a dark horse at this stage, to be honest with you. When Marcelo Bielsa came in, there was a lot of Uruguayans who were wary of it. They've gone from a manager who was really pragmatic to one, as we know, is pretty crazy when it comes to his style of play. And it's normally all out of attack and not worry about the defence. And that showed early on in the first few games, to be honest with you. Conceded quite a few goals, were getting results. But the real tests were Brazil and Argentina. And this is when like the journalist was almost like waiting for him to fall. And he went the complete opposite way. Now they beat Brazil 2-0. Brazil didn't have a shot on target in the entire match. And that was the first time in history since Opta had began that Brazil had not had a shot on target in a game. And then he went away to Buenos Aires and beat Argentina 2-0 with counter-attacking play. And what they did is just soaked up the pressure and almost reverted away from being a little bit gung-ho. So it's been really impressive to see, to be honest with you. I'm still not 100% sure what we're going to get in the Copa America. You know, when people always say these are the dark horses in the competition and they fall. I think it was Turkey in a previous Euros where everyone had backed them and then they fell in the group stage. It may not be like that because Copa America is slightly different. But I don't think they're dark horses. They've proven, right, against the best two teams in the tournament or the best two teams in South America, that they can go toe-to-toe with them. And, yeah, like looking across their actual midfield and then also the strikers, you've touched on Nunes, but Nicolas De La Cruz, he's probably the best player in South America as a midfielder, who's just moved across from River Plate to Flamengo. Like, he sits in behind and he's got the same amount of assists as Lionel Messi and goals, sorry, in the World Cup South American qualifying. Darwin Nunes, after, it was really interesting actually, after his comeback goals against Newcastle in the Premier League, they obviously interviewed him afterwards and said, oh, what was Klopp like for this, or has he instilled a bit more confidence in you? And he didn't even acknowledge Klopp, and he said, I owe it all to Bielsa. And he's just been completely different for Uruguay, and he's built this beautiful relationship with De La Cruz, and then in behind them they've got Valverde from Madrid, obviously, and Ugarte from PSG. It's a star-studded team, and then it's combined with a few South American players and youngsters on the wings. He's looking for a little bit of pace. They've got obviously Palestri, but Maxi Arujo from Toluca. That's where there was a lot of question marks at first, because they're going, why are you trusting like players who are operating in like Mexico or South America combined with this experience? But the combination has worked beautifully, and it'd be really interesting to see. The only sort of doubts I have about this, and maybe this I'm reading too much into it, but Bielsa said he wanted to have really tough testing fixtures coming into this friendlies in terms of preparing themselves against European opposition. Now, they've got Ivory Coast and Basque Country as their two international friendlies before Copa America. So I don't know how that's happened, or Bielsa must be fuming, because he wanted like big names like Brazil, have obviously got Spain and England, and have really tested themselves. And for me, that would have been a really good indication to see if Uruguay are a good price. I still think they are worth backing. I think they are the alternative team to Brazil, and they're the opposite end of the draw for them in terms of facing Argentina potentially to the final. So, yeah, they are a good price, but it would have just been really interesting to see them play a half-decent team away from... That's not me knocking Ivory Coast. It's definitely me knocking Basque Country. It would have been great to see them play someone like England and test themselves. So that's where they're a little bit of an unknown quantity. But in South America, they've proven themselves 100%.
Nathan, I'm intrigued. How do Uruguay fans and Bielsa, I suppose, view Darwin Nunes? Is he seen as like a worthy successor to Suarez and Cavani? Because I know for Premier League fans, he's quite Marmite, isn't he? Some people think he's brilliant. Liverpool fans think he's excellent, and others aren't too sure on him. He's quite wasteful. So how is he viewed in his home country?
He's absolutely adored, to be honest with you. Like, he's taking that position. Like, Suarez and Cavani have almost given him... Suarez has come out and given him his blessing and said that he's the best person to lead the line. Like, Suarez has been called back into the team because he scored like 20, 25 goals in Brazil last year. But he said he's there to be more as part of the squad and the dressing room, really, for his experience. But he's happy for Darwin Nunes to come in and lead the line. And yeah, look, we see him regularly for the Premier League, and Liverpool obviously creates so many chances, and he probably should score a few more. But Uruguay became this really good counter-attacking team. We saw it against Argentina. And Nunes took his opportunities. He only had one or two, and was the difference in that game. And I think you just see a different side of him and his confidence for Uruguay. He seems safe in that environment. He knows that he's loved, where obviously in the Premier League there's opinions left, right and centre, even within Liverpool's own fan base. So I think his game goes up a notch, and he trusts himself. And like, at the end of the day, he is a good striker, and the same with anyone in any job, isn't it? It's all about confidence. So I actually think Bielsa has actually been such a huge blessing for him. And I think the fact that Suarez has come out and made that statement, I mean, one of the best strikers of our generation to say that to you, it's going to give you that extra boost, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's 7 wins from 9 for them since the World Cup. Nathan, they were one of your picks for the tournament when you wrote a bumper Copa America preview for Betting Expert back in January, I think it's fair to say. I'll add a link to that in the show notes if anybody wants to check it out. But is that a tip you'll stand by?
Yeah, 100%. I think when I wrote that, that's when Brazil didn't even know who the next manager was. Obviously, I couldn't touch them. But even the reasons I've spoken about now, like, there's too many problems, I feel like, to fix at a short price. And if you wanted an each-way swing, you're going to get your money back if they get to the final. And I think that's the right way to play. And I think the price is fairly generous. I've already touched on like Mexico and US and Canada. Like, their prices are way too short to be touching, to be honest. So, yeah, if you don't want to back Argentina, definitely steer towards Uruguay.
Okay. Very, very quick quiz question, because we do love that on the Betting Expert podcast. But I'm not expecting either of you to get it. But
that's a good sign, isn't it?
Links, yeah, what, it's a good sign. I don't even know if it's true, but what links Steve Mandanda and Ben White?
A question maybe, I did not expect to hear today.
Maybe take something from where I put this in the show and the Marcelo Bielsa selection section.
Well, White played under Bielsa at Leeds.
He did.
Didn't he?
He did.
Did Mandanda feature under him at all, ever?
He did.
I'm presuming so by the question, but...
Yes, yes, he did. So those are the only two players who have played every minute of a league season under Marcelo Bielsa since he moved to Europe.
Oh, interesting. I would never have got that, so I'm glad you told us the answer. Yeah. That was an awkward 30 seconds.
I kind of figured that. Wasn't expecting anything. So moving on to the rest of the carpet, I think a quick word is needed on some of the others. Manager Nestor Lorenzo took charge of Colombia in July 2022 and has yet to lose a match. They've beaten Brazil and Germany since then. Nathan, what do you think of them at around 13.0 odds?
I think it's a fair price. Like you said, that can't really go unnoticed. Unbeaten in 2 years, I can't sit here and say otherwise. And he's been a bit of a revolution for them. Obviously failed to reach the last World Cup and it was a bit of a car crash, but they've changed really. And like away from the obvious players, James Rodriguez is still firmly in the picture and you've got Luis Diaz, but they've brought back a couple of other players who people may not be aware of. Rafael Borja up top. He used to play for River Plate a few years ago and was one of the best players to strikers seemingly to come out of South America at the time. And then if you look at their midfield as well, John Arias, who is the unsung hero at Fluminense, who probably, arguably, could have a move to Europe. I just don't think he wants it. So they have pockets of talent in and around, but they've become more pragmatic, to be honest with you. They recognise away from home how to shut up shop, which is a good quality to have, especially in South American qualifiers. I've touched on how difficult it is, really. And they've had three away games in the South American qualifiers, haven't conceded and haven't lost. But then I've also touched about their massive home advantage in Barranquilla, where it's sweltering hot by that Caribbean Sea. No one enjoys going in there, hence why Brazil went and strolled, especially with Denise's style of play. So maybe I'm being a bit harsh, but if you take out that home form, like I don't know if there is enough quality in there on a neutral pitch to beat the likes of Argentina, for example. So I think the price is fair. I'd rather go with Colombia than over the North American nations heading to Copa America. But for me, there isn't enough quality there. I think there's a lot of pressure on Luis Diaz to bag. James Rodriguez is still firmly in the picture, but he couldn't get in at Sao Paulo last season and his legs have almost gone, to be honest with you. So he's in there to sort of assist and sit in that 4-5-1 formation. But I think that's an indication of where Colombia are at the moment in terms of like they haven't got anyone really progressing through who's going to be that next star in Europe. So for me, I think it is a fair price. I can't knock them with their record, but I don't know if they'd have enough. They'd be the sort of the team who would be hoping extra time drags on to penalties and sort of scraping through that way if they are to play the likes of Argentina. So I wouldn't encourage it, but I also wouldn't put anybody off if they wanted to have like an outside swing at the tournament.
Okay. Last one on the Copa, Ecuador as well are at around 19.0 to win the tournament. I think they're the only side to have beaten Bielsa's Uruguay and plenty of talented players in the squad, but I suppose they're on the younger side. Take away the goalkeepers from their most recent squad and the average age is around 24. Nathan, maybe this tournament has just come a bit soon for this squad.
Yeah, potentially. When we say dark horses, I actually have a bit of a soft spot for Ecuador. I quite like them, to be honest. It might be a team to sort of back and trade out at a short price. I think that might be the most intelligent way to back them. And yeah, they've got younger players coming through, but look, Kendry Páez, he's unbelievable. Moses Caicedo in the middle. There's almost that Chelsea link already. If you go back and watch the World Cup qualifiers, like those two are just in sync with each other. Now they've got other youngsters coming through. Kevin Rodriguez, who's just moved across from Independiente de Valle, where Kendry Páez is, to Belgium. He's having a good season there. Alan Minder, who I've touched upon with Circle Bruges already, he's come across from Independiente de Valle as well. They have one of the best academies in South America. So they are finding these niche, like good little players, really, but they're also proven from a young age. So yes, they have a young team, but there's so much quality within there. it's the striker department which worries me a little bit. Enner Valencia, 34, like he's had a good season in Brazil, but his legs are going. He missed a lot of opportunities in the Libertadores to almost carry them to the final, and he's probably going to have less chances for Ecuador in certain matches. But the other end of the pitch, they've got experience of Felix Torres. Keep an eye on him. He's 27, but Corinthians have just bought him for 5-6 million, and he's really strong, and they almost line up with a back five as well, so they are really hard to break down. And then a team with Kendry Páez, like he's the one to watch this summer. I know we spoke about Endrick, but wow, what a player he is. Similar qualities to Kaká, the way he glides up the pitch and into that final third. It's a bold statement, but the more I watch him, I can't believe he's only like 17 years of age. It's going to be, I'm really upset he's going to Chelsea, if I'm going to be honest with you. I think it's almost a little bit ruined, but that's a conversation for another day. But I think at their price, almost look to trade them out. I think I put them in my column to potentially upset and win the group at odds against. So I'll definitely stand by that. But yeah, back them and trade out, depending on how the draw goes, will be probably one of the best sort of clever plays in Copa America.
Fantastic. I do want to touch briefly on the Copa Libertadores as well. The group stage draw was made this week. Nathan, what are your early thoughts on the draw? And are there any exciting storylines or things to look out for someone who doesn't really know that much about the situation?
The group stage draw was actually really bleak this year, which was really sad. But from a betting point of view, there's loads of good opportunities. We spoke about Bolivian teams. So Bolivar going to be playing Flamengo. Flamengo, obviously, the best team in South America and really short favourites. A lot of people will be backing them. I won't be doing it because they are way too short for the price I'd be liking, but it wouldn't surprise me if Flamengo pick up that title again. Obviously, Brazilian teams have won the last five and are starting to dominate it. And finally, the market from bookmakers are picking up on that. But there is one team who I do really like at a big price, and not to blow my own horn too much, but last year backed Fluminense 25-1. I've had 4 out of 5 last winners. So if anybody wants a big price, I'm looking at Botafogo at 18s. I don't understand it at all, to be honest with you. I think all the other Brazilian teams are single price, maybe Sao Paulo are 10s, but Botafogo at 18s. Now, John Texter's come into the club, also owns Crystal Palace and Lyon, and there's lots of different opinions around him. However, he's put his hand in his pocket this year, and they came close to the title last year, but they were just lacking depth. Now he's gone out and bought Real Betis's Luis Henrique for 20 million, a Brazil record. He isn't the only one. They've bought in 6 to 8 players, a lot of experience. Damian Suarez from Getafe, you know, he was playing against Real Madrid earlier in the season, and he's been convinced to go across at 35. I mean, in South America, that doesn't mean anything. But they've also bought Jefinho on loan from Lyon because there's that link there. He was previously at Botafogo and highly rated, but just hasn't had the opportunity in Europe. Junior Santos has scored 8 goals in qualifying. I think because they've come through the qualifying stage, because they fell into that 4th, 5th spot in the Brazil top flight last season, they've almost been overlooked. But they do look strong, to be honest. And I just don't get the price. If I was to be pricing at Botafogo, I'd have them around 6-7-1. So the fact that they're 18s is just incredible value, to be honest with you. I do like, again, maybe there's an Ecuadorian theme here in terms of backing a team to cash out at a price, in terms of Independiente de Valle and Quito. Now, both of them have won the last two Sudamericanas. They have the altitude advantage at home. Quito just lost out to Fluminense in the Recopa Sudamericana, which is almost like a glorified community shield, but I mean it in a good way. And like, both sets of teams take it really seriously. It's 2 legs. They won the first one 1-0 in Ecuador and then lost 2-1 to a last minute penalty in Brazil. But really well set up, well drilled teams. Independiente de Valle, yes, they have Kendry Páez, but they have one of the best academies in South America. They're both priced around 25-33s. So a case of like, if you like a big price and then want to cash out as they advance through from the group stage, I wouldn't knock that at all. But Botafogo at 18s look huge. If I'm going to throw anything else a bit closer to the line, I quite like the look of Atletico Mineiro. Now they've got Hulk up top. He's still going at 37, but he had over 20 goals last season. Paulinho, who's worked his way into the Brazilian national team, he scored 20 goals in Brazil's top flight last season, none of which were penalties. And they've just invested 5 million in Gustavo Scarpa. So maybe this is me having a bit of a soft spot with him being at Forest. But before that, he was a Brasileiro Player of the Year in 2022. So him pulling the strings behind the best strike partnership in South America it's worth a swing. Perhaps defensively they aren't the most solid, but a Brazilian team will win this. Okay, so one of five chance for a 6-1. But yeah, I'm going to leave it out there. Botafogo 18s is the one which really catches the eye for me.
Okay,
hey, you mentioned Gustavo Scarpa there. How come he's gone back to Brazil? Because I know he didn't feature too much, but every time I saw him, he looked really bright. And he looked like there was a real player there, probably could play Premier League football.
Yeah, actually a really interesting story around Gustavo Scarpa. So he was meant to be going to Olympiacos. Obviously, Marinakis owns Nottingham Forest and Olympiacos. Marinakis loves a number 10, loves like a big name, which is going to get shirt sales, i.e. James Rodriguez, who he's recently bought, and then he got Joel Carvalho from Nottingham Forest previously. He loves to have a number 10, and likes to have an influence on who's actually playing, especially with Olympiacos. I don't think it's that way at Forest. But 24 hours before he was meant to be signed for Olympiacos, he always wanted to come across and test himself in Europe because he had that capability, he won everything in Brazil. He got told that he was going to Nottingham Forest. Now, Steve Cooper's opened the door one day and he's got Brazilians sat in his waiting room and he had no idea who he was. And almost Gustavo Scarpa didn't know until 24 hours before either. He was already in Europe, couldn't have his medicals, and then got shipped to Forest. And yeah, it was a crying shame because I highly rated him in Brazil and I made a bit of noise about him. And I think he actually did quite well in the limited games for Forest.
He looked good.
But yeah. it wasn't a Cooper signing, and he almost tried to make a point out of that because he wasn't the one brought in, to be honest. So yeah, he went to Olympiacos on loan, but that didn't work out either. And his time in Europe was a bit of a sham, but he's gone back to like a promising team managed by Philippe Scolari, by the way. Like, he made the move last season. So you've got Scolari, Scarpa, Paulinho and Hulk. Like, it's a good combination. And he's already won three Libertadores. He hasn't won one since 1999, Scolari, but at the age of 75, this may be his last chance. So that could be a fairy tale ending, couldn't it?
Very good. All hail the multi-club model. So you mentioned there's five consecutive tournament winners for teams from Brazil. It's the most successful run a country's ever had at the Libertadores. Why is that? And when do you expect it to change? You said you expect another Brazilian winner this year.
In a word, money. The way the money's pumped into the leagues. So, for example, Quito, who won the Sudamericana, have only spent $1.5 million over the last two decades, maybe even longer from my research. Where obviously Botafogo came in, and who haven't won anything in forever, spent $20 million on one player and broke the record. So there's money within the league for transfers. They're now being owned by European like investors and Arab investors that have opened the market up to there. So obviously John Textor, they're trying to make the league appealing, and they have stolen players back from Europe this summer, which has been massively interesting. I think they outspent the Liga in the recent windows, which is massively like eye-catching, to be honest with you. So yes, it may become a bit more commercial, but at the same time, they are trying to build a league to make sure that their players don't leave it, which is sort of hands off and respect to them. They have to sort of go down this route of money. So Argentina, I said at the start of the podcast, like Argentina have just signed, their president has just signed off a policy to allow their clubs to also be politically owned by European and Arab investors, where before they weren't. A lot of clubs are hesitant. Fans don't want that, which you can understand. But without that, they can't compete. For example, if we look at Boca Juniors, they've sold an abundance of talent really over the last year. Alan Varela, who's gone to Porto, Valentin Barco, who's gone to Brighton, all less than 10 million because they've been under so much financial restraint and pressure. They're having to sell youth products for next to nothing. And they're not even in the Libertadores, even though they made the final last year. So like, Argentinian football is falling behind. I think even Ecuadorian teams, as I've mentioned, are probably stronger than Argentinian sides now. But they don't have money as well. It's just the case of Ecuadorian teams are almost doing like a mini Brighton in terms of they're preparing these lads to sell them for money and looking to try and use some of that money or a fraction of that money to make sure that they can be sustainable as well. Where Brazilian teams, there's just so much money there. But it's really annoying because it's only this year that the bookmakers have caught on. They haven't for the last few years. Like Fluminense last year, 25-1 was ridiculous. So I'm hoping they've made a mistake with Botafogo again this year, but time will tell.
Fantastic. You mentioned a few, and it's the last one on the Libertadores, but looking at the group stage, looking at the outrights, are there any other value bets for people for this tournament at this very early stage?
There will be. I know Sam's commissioned me a piece for the Copa Libertadores. So that'll probably be a hearty read. And within that, they've released markets in the last week or so on, like, to qualify out of the group. And there's a lot of groups where River Plate don't have a Brazilian team or any altitude, so they won't have any problems, and they're six on. But then that creates good prices for one of the other teams to nick that second spot. So nothing just as of yet. You have to wait for that, but it will definitely be included in the article. So definitely check that out when it goes live. It's a nice little plug.
Very good plug. Fantastic. Let's close it off here. Get some plugs in for you, Nathan. You've got your Copper Club magazine. Happy first birthday to the magazine, first of all.
Thank you very much. Old.
Very nice. For those who aren't familiar with the Copper Club magazine, you really, really should be. Absolutely top quality writing and analysis. Design is beautiful. You've released a new issue this week as well, Nathan, number 4. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I'm very excited too. So please tell us all about it.
Yeah, do you know what? That feeling when you do sign up for a magazine is unbelievable, man. I literally take 2 days to do nothing because this one's been a beast. It's about 20,000 words, but this one's actually really special because like the opening magazine, the first issue, was all around the Copa Libertadores team guide, where I just sort of used my knowledge, which I thought was maybe too niche, to sort of try and educate people. And it was really well received, to be honest with you. So like, I'll always do that as like the first issue of each year. Where issue 3 was more like feature based and like exclusives with Tim Vickery. So like, look, we get some really big names in it. The last one took about 4 months to put together, and this one was about 2 or 3. But yeah, look, all around like educating people around South American football, but in a digestible way. So we look at formations, manager changes, but like what stadiums are going to be playing at, key players, ones to watch. There's hundreds of players within their analyze who could potentially be on the way to Europe, and just breaking it down. And so look, if people do want to get involved in the Libertadores, you've got a handy guide on every single team, and like it can be good for a betting preview. Like we don't have odds and that in here. We try and keep it as neutral as possible, but like it's a huge education for people to get to know what happened last season and what they can expect to see this year, really. And like, look, transfers is the buzzword, isn't it, in terms of what people want. So analyze at least 2 or 3 players, and all done within like 500-600 words per team. So like it's a nice, simple read, but might may take you a day or two because it is fairly long. But yeah, and no, I'm really excited to get that one out. Like it's been really well received, sold about 75-80% of stock on the pre-order. So like, do grab yours now before they do sell out, because we don't reprint.
Fantastic. I'll get my order in before we publish this episode. So beat the rush. So aside from your betting expert author's page, Nathan, which is the obvious best starting place, where else can people find you and your content? You host a podcast as well, The Copper Club.
Yeah, the Copper Club podcast is something, an idea pretty much similar to you guys, really, launched probably about 8 months ago. And I'm going to keep using his name because it's a big one. But we've got Tim Vickery on. We've had the likes of Kevin Hatchard. And we've got a really good trio now in me, Peter Pankowski and Callum Goodall. Like, definitely check those guys out on social media. Like, their knowledge around South American football is second to none. Really value their opinion, and like as a trio we do actually put together quite a decent episode every couple of weeks. So we analyze the transfer window, we look at the Copa Libertadores, we've got a Copa America mini series coming up where we've got a guest from each sort of nation who specialize in that particular area, where there'll be 20-30 minute episodes. I say that they're probably going to be 40 minutes, let's be honest. But we cover everything, and it's like been really well received, and it's probably, away from the magazines, it's probably one of the best things we do, to be honest with you. And I love jumping on the podcast, and it's, we make it as digestible and for a European audience as possible. It's no, we never like overcomplicate it, and we draw comparisons and where players can fit if Premier League teams are interested. So yeah, look, it's the main place to go really for South American content and players. No one else really does it or dedicated the time as we do. So yeah, definitely check us out on Spotify, Apple, everywhere in between.
But yeah, no, you're right there. As someone who doesn't really have a historical interest in South American football, I found any episode of the podcast that you've put out, it's easy jumping in point for anyone who maybe wants to learn a little bit more. So
I appreciate that. And I didn't even tell you to say that, so that's all good.
You didn't? No, you didn't. You can pay me after. So thank you very much, Nathan Joyce, for joining us. We'll surely have you again soon, but really good talk.
No, thanks, pleasure. Thank you.